We're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board. Wild Will Erskine booking the guests. And the legendary CHML newsroom, Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML. The biggest housing plan in the free world. That's the next installment of the pre-budget roadside distraction tour. And basically, it's interesting because we have Mike Moffitt on, who's a great guy to talk about housing development from Western and such. And these are all ideas that people like him and the opposition parties have been talking about forever. And now it's like as the libs are doing a nosedive, they're just dragging all of this stuff out, which is a reintroduction and things that have been recommended by housing experts for a long time. So we'll see where that goes. At this point, it doesn't seem to be sticking. The Conservatives are up 3 points. Now, the libs are up one, but it seems to be at the expense of the NDP. They've gone down two. Which is fascinating. And I think a lot of that, the reason being is because Jagmeet Singh has said on this show several times, he's not interested in obtaining power, although he has more power now than he's ever had in the history of this party, being a lever, using his leverage to get what he wants with pharmacare and dental care, even though none of that is moving the meter. And, you know, fascinating that, I think at least if they stood up and took a position and then, fought for it, maybe he'd get leader of the opposition. I don't know, but, clearly he has stated that it's not about being the prime minister for him on this show. It's about implementing policies, which, you know, can you call pharmacare pharmacare? It's hardly that. It's a promise to be that one day. And then the other flip-flop for Jagmeet Singh, was that the carbon tax was not the be-all and end-all. And it's like, my goodness, people have been saying that forever. And all of a sudden, Canadians are starting to realize it. It's not about denying climate change. It's about, is this the best way to get results? And the answer is no. And the country is finally realizing that there are other ways to save the planet than by taxing the hell out of Canadians to change their behavior into something that isn't developed yet when we emit 1.5% of the world's greenhouse gases. So, there's lots of ways to help. It's called liquid natural gas, and it's called putting the incentives and the onus on business and not the backs of taxpayers to, I don't know, park their car and get on their bicycle and drive and ride 60 minutes to work. I mean, it's just insane. So for Jagmeet Singh to come out and say the carbon tax is not the be all and the end all, and then vote along with the Conservatives and Pierre Poilievre to meet with the premiers and have a debate on carbon tax and talk and have a meeting about this and what debate perhaps is the wrong word, at least discuss what other options there are. And, you know, Trudeau's spouting that, you know, nobody's coming up with another plan. Well, they all have plans. Their plans are just not other taxes like yours, which is, again, what Jagmeet Singh said on the show last time he was on when, you know, blowing a gasket about Pierre Poilievre saying that the BC had a federal carbon tax. They don't. They've got a provincial carbon tax, which is way more expensive, as they pay like, you know, $2.15 a liter for gasoline. So, again, it's amazing how this is finally coming to the forefront, where Canadians who don't agree with a carbon tax are not climate deniers. Most of the population is concerned about climate change and want to move forward and change ways. They're just questioning whether this is the right way to do it. And now even NDP leader Jagmeet Singh is doing that in an incredible flip-flop, in which has Trudeau on his back leg saying, well, you know, and in times get tough, you got to, you know, stand up for what you believe in. It's my goodness. There is nothing left that this man has not ruined, whether it is, you know, a population explosion, stressing house cares, stressing EMS, stressing health care, stressing right down to the shelter system. I mean, my goodness. And now it comes out with a grandioso plan to build houses in the next decade when he's out of office. It's incredible. But at least people are starting to realize the smoke and mirrors that is Justin Trudeau and the carbon tax. Again, other ways to do it. That's what people are saying. And everybody says, well, this is the most inexpensive way. I'm not sure about that. And I'm not sure we can believe much of what Trudeau says, considering what he has been saying over the last 6 months, including just this week into the inquiry to foreign interference in the last two elections, which have been proven to have benefited the Liberal government. So again, everything else he's done just a terrible job at, but carbon tax, that's the one thing he's got right. Why would you possibly buy into that? I don't know if you've heard the terrible news. Only 3 months after their lavish televised wedding ceremony, Jerry Turner and Teresa Nist of The Golden Bachelor have announced their divorce. During a Friday appearance of Good Morning America, the ex-couple broke the news about their separation, said they hope the divorce doesn't discourage other people in their 70s from dating. Well, maybe not that, but certainly from taking it to the TV. Let's bring in Bill Breaux, TV critic and author. He's with us now. Bill, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am, Scott, but I'm just shocked. Shocked. I can't believe it.
So, okay. I understand it's TV. But is all this planned ahead of time? Like, do they know they've got an out that, like, you know, because I was looking, I read the article and they said, well, it sounds like they didn't really talk about where they were going to live after they were married. And I don't know. Back in the day when you have to go to marriage counseling and all that sort of crap before you got married, it was, have you decided about where you're going to live and kids? So I understand the kids part, not an issue, but you don't think they would have discussed this at all?
Yeah. You know, look, they're both in their 70s. Just pick a town next to a Red Lobster, right? Like, go somewhere where there's an early supper and there you go. I don't know what, right? Get your priorities.
This is all scripted. How does it work? Like, if you're Jerry and Teresa, what sort of contract are you in? How does this all play out and then end up on an editing room floor in what we see?
I think that the cynic in me does agree that, yeah, this does seem scripted, that basically if you want to create intrigue in the next season of The Golden Bachelor, you have something happen and a divorce, sure. Then one of those two is now back in the running for another mate. And so you bring that audience along.
I didn't even look forward enough to see that. I'm just still so devastated by this initial news.
Yeah. You know, I think that I don't really think that's what's happened here. I just think these two people had fun making a TV show, and then they didn't know each other at all. And, The fact that they couldn't pick between New Jersey and North Carolina, I mean, I can make that call for them. I've been to both those places. That's an easy one. But, I think that this just literally two reasonable people who were a little more mature said, what are we doing this for? And really, if you're in your 70s, why are you getting married again anyway? I guess so.
You know, that is an interesting point. So why the attraction? Because they've had many bachelors. It's like a Survivor show. There's various versions of all of this. Why did this one work?
Well, it's brilliant in a way. You know, most people who watch television, and we've talked about this before, but the median age of broadcast network TV, and we're talking about CBS, ABC, NBC, CBC, CTV, it's like 55, it's a lot older than you think. And so having seniors as part of the dating scene, you're going to get most of your viewing audience are going to be right there, and so it seems like a smart idea. Although I have to say, this aired, I believe, on City TV in Canada, wasn't really as big a hit as it was stateside. I'm not sure why.
So it was more popular in the United States than it was here.
Yeah, I guess, and again, I don't have a real answer. Maybe it could be the Fox network there is just a bigger deal. But that was the statistics I saw. It didn't draw like a regular Bachelor. But even the regular Bachelor, these shows have been on so long now, they're not quite the big red-hot shows that they once were.
That being said, will this continue? You're anticipating one will go on. Do you think this franchise will keep going?
It will. Oh, for sure. I mean, they've had like the Tiniest Bachelor and the fattest bachelor. Like, if you go, like, I'm sorry, not the fattest, the large, whatever the proper term
right.
is.
Yeah.
Excuse my stupidity here. But the I've covered this long enough to see the different variations. And there's, you know, there's no bottom to this. There's no point where humiliating people on television stops being a consumer brand. And so okay. I think we're going to see more of it. Yeah.
All right. So I can't let you go without asking you about O.J. Simpson and the day after. How do you feel about this? I saw one reporter say it's people are divided on this, and that would be accurate, wouldn't it?
Sure. If anybody's divided or thrown a spotlight on the divisions in society in the last 30 years, it was the O.J. Simpson trial and the result. And so there's many, many reasons why it's divisive. I felt kind of sad. You know, I had just watched, I'd showed in Hamilton some films on the Wednesday, old sports reels, and they were scenes of O.J. Simpson running for the Buffalo Bills in the late 60s and 70s, and how spectacular he was as a running back. The thing that struck me, though, was these crummy little helmets that they wore. They looked like they were cardboard. And I just thought, this guy may have had 55 concussions. Like, he still holds NFL records. So, you know, there's no excuse. But, you know, it's just such a complex story. And it may have, it sort of played out in some ways because we've had miniseries. We've had Jay Leno make 1,000 jokes. Judge Ito and Cato Kaelin. And, you know, even on the Seinfeld, there was a whole character based on Johnny Cochran. So it's something that even if you weren't around then, you know, my kids are in their early 30s. They know all about this, even though they didn't watch it, because it was part of the culture. It was on The Simpsons, right?
It's amazing how even the day after we're sort of peeling back this onion and finding things. And I'm not sure what we get out of this at the other end. It's very bizarre.
It is. A lot of red people are saying, if only Norm MacDonald were still alive to make jokes.
Oh, you know, man.
He basically got fired from Saturday Night Live Weekend Anchor for saying, well, this just in, murder is now legal in California.
Yeah.
That was his, you know, so it was a big joke, except it wasn't if you were the Goldmans or the family of Nicole Brown.
Absolutely.
And
Bill Brio with us, TV critic and author, The Golden Bachelor. Bill's confident it's going to return. Good news there. Thank you, Bill. Be well. Have a great weekend.
Okay, you too, Scott.
Randall Denley says that Trudeau's attempt to blame Ontario Premier Doug Ford, or any of the premiers for that matter, for the carbon tax isn't fooling anyone. His latest column in the Ottawa Citizen and the National Post, Trudeau's attempt to blame Ford for the carbon tax isn't fooling anyone. Canceling cap and trade was one of the best moves the Ontario Premier ever made. And joining us now, Randall Denley, author and columnist for the Ottawa Citizen and the Post. He's here now. Randall, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I am, Scott. Thanks.
It's interesting because I read this column this morning, Randall, and then later this afternoon, I'm watching the Prime Minister's announcement on housing, and he's announced the biggest housing initiative, plan, whatever, that, you know, in Canada's history or in a bazillion decades, what have you, even though a lot of it's stuff that the opposition or housing experts have been saying for quite a while. And one thing that he said in this news conference was the provinces will need to step up to solve this problem. We can't do it alone. And it's sort of what you're talking about here. There's always some sort of distraction.
Yeah, he's quite the hero of housing these days. You know, he's been patient while these municipalities and provinces opposed housing, dragged their heels, they've done nothing. Well, finally, he has to step in. The clip from Sean Fraser, the housing minister. Oh, we hope they can match our ambition.
Yeah.
if you're involved with the provincial government, housing, municipal government, you just roll your eyes up and stuff like that. Both those levels of government in Ontario have been doing a lot of useful things to speed up housing. But still, the premise of the Trudeau plan this week is, well, we just need to, you know, turn up the dials here and more houses will come out the other end. It doesn't really take into account the fact that we have a shortage of tradespeople, shortage of supplies, and most critically, a shortage of people who can afford to buy houses. You know, there was a story in the last week or so in Toronto. They've had a huge number of unsold houses. They're built or under construction, not sold, way more than they've had in recent years. Why? Because people look at the interest rates and the cost of the house and go, well, I'd like to have a house, but can't afford that. And I think that's, you know, that's the big problem. And it's also a problem that's driven to a significant degree by the amount of immigration that's happened in the last few years under the Trudeau government.
Yeah.
Something that Trudeau himself acknowledged the other day.
Yeah.
Quickly finds out who was responsible for that.
Well, again, there's another example of the distraction. He's selling a problem or a solution to a problem and denying that he created it. It's very bizarre. Are Canadians falling for this?
I don't think so, but they're going to like bits and pieces of what he announced. You know, extending the mortgage amortization out to 30 years will let some more people into the market, but you've still got the same supply problem. We got lots of buyers. That's not really the issue. Lots of people are wanting to buy, but they can't afford it. This is going to help just a little bit, but it's not going to produce any more houses. I just, you know, you can see in their attempts to do something about housing, this is not really the federal government zone. They haven't been in it for years.
Yeah.
Just last summer, Trudeau was saying, well, I don't really see housing as a primary responsibility of the federal government, which has been his thinking. You know, well, we had a plan. We spent some money, but it's not really our thing. And you can see with the stuff that they lay out, they don't really have the fine detail. And what I'm writing about in my post column is the sort of fake fight between Ford and Trudeau. Well, you know, you've got to allow a fourplex on every individual residential lot. The provincial government's already changed that, so the single-family zone house can now have three units on it. Four are going to make a big difference. I don't think so. But that
and also, and you brought this up in your column, Randall, is that you can still get a fourplex. The only difference is you have to get municipal approval for it. It's not like they're not allowed. You can still do it. It's just that under four, meaning three and below, you don't have to get that sort of authority.
Yeah, and a certain type of urbanist thinkers have made a big deal out of this. We need more density.
Yeah,
it's appalling. We've got these, you know, single-family zoning areas, which, you know, a big part of any city, like it's a terrible thing. But people can make changes now. You know, three units, great, go ahead and do it. But it's always going to be kind of a boutique element of the housing industry because these are all one-off, unique projects. They're going to produce a few units here, a few units there, but it is not anything that's comparable to putting up a 300-unit apartment building or 2,000-home subdivision, something that's actually going to produce volume of housing. These are just little, almost symbolic things. So they're not worth fighting about. And when the federal government says, well, we might not give Ontario access to some of this housing money because you're not following our rules. Like, well, if you want more housing, what's the point of punishing the Ontario government because they don't agree with everything Trudeau says?
You're dealing with the same thing with the carbon tax in this column, and I've heard one person say, well, you know, you're paying the carbon tax because you got rid of the cap and trade. And again, the Prime Minister challenging the other premiers to come up with something better, and by that he means another tax. That's exactly the opposite of what the premiers are looking for here, yet he's... Again, you're not, it's my way or the highway.
Yeah, and the person who claims that Doug Ford chose the carbon tax was Justin Trudeau. There's a funny little clip of him you can see on YouTube. He says, they had a cap and trade system in Ontario. Doug Ford got rid of that. Like, what a bonehead play. So then, he chose the carbon tax, in effect, by getting rid of it. How do you say Doug Ford chose a carbon tax? He ran against it. His government went to the Supreme Court to fight it. Lost, unfortunately, but you couldn't have fought much harder against the Trudeau carbon tax than Doug Ford and his government. But now to try to flip it around and say, well, no, he chose it. He chose it, and now he's complaining. I mean, what he chose was no carbon tax. In fact, that's what voters in Ontario chose when they elected him in 2018, because that was part of his platform. So it's I just laughed out loud when I heard that quote from Trudeau, because it's so ridiculous.
It's like
his signature policy. Why blame it on Doug Ford?
It's like, you know, if we cancel the carbon tax, you won't get your check.
Yeah, I'm making a fortune off that carbon tax.
What about the change of position of the NDP in supporting Pierre Poilievre's thing the other day about the debate on TV or with all the premiers and such? It appears that Jagmeet Singh's changing his position on the carbon tax. He said it's not the be-all and the end-all.
I guess word has finally filtered through to Jagmeet that
yeah.
This thing isn't as popular as we've been told. Yeah, I think he's, I was going to say wisely, but I suppose... that might be an exaggeration, but he is trying to put a little bit of distance between himself and Trudeau because, you know, looking ahead to the next election, whenever it's going to be, I think today people can say to the NDP leader, well, why would I vote for your party? You're no different than the Liberal Party. And whatever they say, you're just going to go along with it anyway. So why don't I just vote Liberal? Because, you know, what's the difference? And he's got to find some things. He goes, oh, no, we are different. We've got this, we've got that. I'd say it's a little late in the game for him to develop a degree of skepticism about the carbon tax. But, you know, in fact, he's right when he says we can live without it.
Hmm.
I thought it was interesting a couple of weeks ago, the Climate Change Institute, which is a government-funded, you know, pro-climate change organization, looked at all the different elements of the things the government is doing, what's going to produce what percentage of the reductions. Oh, there's the carbon tax down there. Well, maybe, you know, 8 or 9% of what we're looking for overall. And yet it's all we ever talk about.
Like good point.
The carbon tax will either save us or we'll all die without it. You could get rid of it, it would make very little difference in the overall effort to reduce emissions. So it's been something where the benefit of it has been exaggerated on the get-go, and it still is. And I think that's part of what's so silly about Trudeau just fighting so hard on the carbon tax, all about the carbon tax.
Randall Denley with us.
Don't want
it. Yeah, Randall Denley is with us, author and columnist for the Ottawa Citizen and the National Post. His latest there, Trudeau's attempt to blame Ford for the carbon tax isn't fooling anyone. As always, Randall, thanks for the time. Be well.
Yeah, my pleasure, Scott.
The Supreme Court of Canada says it will not hear arguments about the release of prison and parole documents concerning serial killer Paul Bernardo. The decision marks the end of a year-long battle to expose confidential information used to decide Bernardo's prospects for parole. Remember that he was transferred from a maximum to a medium security prison a while ago, and seemingly nobody aware of this until the very last minute. Timothy Danson here. He is a lawyer for the Mahaffey and French families and here now. Tim, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks for having me on your show.
First, Tim, are you surprised at this decision?
I'm actually very, very surprised because there's a very set criteria that the Supreme Court of Canada uses in whether or not to grant leave. And people should know it's very difficult to get leave. 90, 92% of all leave applications are dismissed. So we're looking at 8 to 10%, and then that's proportionally divided among the provinces. Having said that, we met all the criteria. The last time the Supreme Court of Canada looked at this issue, but not nearly in the same scope that that exists today, was over a quarter of a century ago. And one of the great criteria for a leave application is with the passage of time, the Supreme Court will reconsider previous decisions. And the previous decisions had nothing to do with public safety and the parole board or Corrections Canada. So we were quite disappointed. And then 23 years later, in a case called Bird, the Supreme Court of Canada looked at the earlier decision and said, you know, this is a very important issue, but we don't need to decide it in this case, so we'll wait for the right case. And our case was the perfect case. So in that sense, I'm surprised and disappointed. You know, we need to push on. I don't really understand this. I mean, the net effect of this is that the Access to Information Act, which states as its purpose to enhance the accountability and transparency of federal institutions in order to promote an open democratic society to enable public debate on the conduct of these institutions has been rendered meaningless when it comes to Canada's most dangerous offenders. And that's what I don't understand. The application, the Access to Information Act request that we made is targeting probably 1, maybe 2% of the entire prison population. We're not talking about the majority of offenders that have fixed sentences are going to get out. We're talking about people who've committed a murder, in case of Paul Bernardo, also a dangerous offender. There was other offenders that were in our application who murdered police officers, and one person actually executed a police officer. I don't know why we can tolerate as a society that the privacy rights of these individuals, these most dangerous, sadistic, psychopathic murderers, over the rights of the victims and the right of the public to know. How is the public going to be able to evaluate whether the correction and parole system works if critical documentation is kept secret from the public? I don't understand it. It's a great disappointment. But now we need to have Canadians, and we'll assist in this, to go to the members of parliament and demand legislative change to correct this injustice.
Is this all specifically around information regarding the transfer from the maximum to the medium security prison and what criteria were used there?
No, I mean, that would be part of it, but that's no. Right. Our main focus on these ATIP applications were to get access to the very documentation, and we'll use Paul Bernardo as an example because he was one of the people, to get the documentation that Paul Bernardo relies upon to be relieved from the full consequences of his life sentence and be reintegrated back into the community. So public safety and the public interest is at a very heightened degree. Mm-hmm. So that we can, evaluate what he's relying upon to be released and what the parole board is looking at to determine whether or not he's a risk. I mean, you know, his trial is public, his sentencing is public, his dangerous offender application is public. Why all of a sudden at the end stage of the sentence, which is now parole, that all of a sudden, you know, this is kept from the public, it's kept from the victims, so we can't make informed decisions? Because I'll tell you, the victims use this information in their victim impact statements, and they address issues of public safety. So, I don't understand. We have free, you know, constitutional protection for free expression, the freedom of the press, freedom of the media. Victims, we rely on the media to get the story out. So keeping this secret and so that they can't be held accountable makes absolutely no sense to us.
Timothy Danson with us, lawyer for the Mahaffey and French family. Supreme Court of Canada says it will not hear arguments about the release of prison and parole documents concerning serial killer Paul Bernardo and others in his situation. Tim, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer.
He'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
You know, I love the polls. I love the pollsters. I love having them on. It gives us a peek into the minds of Canadians, what they're thinking, what they're doing. And according to a new poll from Liaison Strategies, Doug Ford's Progressive Conservatives still hold a strong lead in the polls. But the interesting fight is for second place. Bonnie Crombie's provincial Liberals are picking up support that would once have gone to the Ontario NDP. And if an election were held today, the outcome would be pretty much the same, except for second place, the Liberals would form the opposition. To talk more about all of this, David Valentin with us, Principal Liaison Strategies, and here now. David, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me.
This is fascinating. Why haven't the NDP resonated in Ontario? It seems that only when the Liberals are doing very poorly that they gain any traction.
Well, I think one theory of the case is they did have an opportunity to focus attention from the province, from Ontarians, onto themselves by holding a leadership race. But of course, some of your listeners may remember, and I'm sure you do, that there was not really a race.
Yeah.
We have Mara Stiles, the new leader. No one ran against her. And so all that race, the coverage, the fundraising, crisscrossing the province to do events for the leadership race, none of that's the place. And, you know, there was no drama behind their convention. We knew what the outcome was going to be. Only one person running. That's the only result. So I do think they shot themselves a little bit in the foot. Now, that being said, how is Mara's style supposed to control whether or not someone wants to run against her, right? I think, you know, from the perspective of trying to become the NDP leader, I can't think of a better situation than just having a candidate to you, I suppose. But there are some drawbacks that come alongside with that because none of that drama was there. On the other hand, we've got an Ontario Liberal leader who was the mayor of one of Ontario's biggest cities, Mississauga, well known in the GTA, but that being said, not as well known in other corners of the province. And we are seeing some of that take place in the polling numbers, right? She's doing better in Toronto, where she's leading. She's competitive in a 905, but not leading there, at least not yet anyway. So I think, you know, the fact that they had a race, they had that coverage, they had that opportunity is probably paying off in some respect.
Yeah, Bonnie Crosby, obviously the more popular candidate at this point, but is it the presentation or even policy? And I guess we can't say policy because we haven't heard much from the Liberal government on this. But it seems that Bonnie Crosby is going to take the Liberals, which were left of center through most of our lifetime. And then, of course, we saw Kathleen Wynne take the Liberals to the extreme left. We're seeing Justin Trudeau do the same federally. Bonnie Crosby seems to be moving it back to the center, very much where Doug Ford is, center right. Is the NDP just too extreme left for all of this now?
Well, I think in some cases they're sort of being left out of the conversation. And I do want to say this poll is pretty bad news for the NDP. There's one silver lining, you know, just to be nice to them. I'll point out that they are very competitive with the Conservatives in the Hamilton and Niagara region. Liberals are only at 20% in that area, which it may be enough to get Dean Catherine back for them. And that would be a start, certainly, because right now they've got nothing. But, you know, a lot of the time, they're just not part of the conversation. So we've been having this full conversation about the carbon tax. The Premier's been saying that Bonnie Crosby wants the tax. Bonnie Crosby now saying, nope, if I was elected Premier, I would not have a carbon tax. Well, where's Merritt Stiles and the NDP in all of this? They're sort of missing from the narrative. So, you know, I think we need to do a better job of making sure they're driving coverage, driving issues. And on some of the things we've seen lately, they haven't been as good as that.
Are they spending too much time trying to cut up the current government as opposed to addressing those kitchen table issues like affordability, which are dominating?
No, I hear you on that, but you know, I think one of the things that is the problem with being an opposition is you have to oppose. And so you had that situation where, you know, they're putting together their critique of the government, they're doing their private members' bills. They're not going to have a real opportunity for a platform until the next election. So there are some limitations to that.
I don't know. At the end of the day, David, I don't think this is all a communications issue or even a popularity issue. The NDP just have not been making a dent with anything that they've saying, anything that they're saying, whether it's the leadership or the leader or not. They just don't seem to be addressing the affordability issues. They just seem to be, well, being the opposition and saying what the governing party isn't doing right, as opposed to really offering solutions. Is that accurate at all?
I think that is accurate. And, you know, there's certainly more they can do on that. I think we're probably going to see more announcements from them as we get closer to the election campaign. But that being said, right now, priority number one has to be introducing the new leader to Ontarians in as many places as possible, as quickly as possible. And, you know, we study the polls a lot. I want to say the most important numbers we're seeing right now are actually the financial numbers, how much the parties are raising. We see that the Conservatives have a huge lead when it comes to the amount of money that they're able to raise. The NDP are in second there, Liberals are in third. So, you know, a lot still to be learned about what they're going to do. And we're seeing these two by-elections coming up provincially, one in Milton, one in Lanark. They're not expected to be, in Lambton, I should say, they're not expected to be competitive in either of those by-elections. So I think they're having some pretty lousy luck to a certain extent, but also they need to figure out a way to be more forward-facing.
David Valentin with us, Principal Liaison Strategies. A new poll suggesting that the fight is for second place and that if an election was held now, the Liberals would be the official opposition. David, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you so much for having me and have a great weekend.
Don't go away. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
We've talked about this issue many, many, many times over the last little while, and I think it's starting to resonate with Canadians in why we're not doing more to get the world off of coal with Canadian liquid natural gas. I mean, we've seen Ontario Power Generation do that in the last several years. We've Alberta's talking about it now. Even our own DeFasco here in Hamilton is using natural gas to transition off of coal to electricity in the blast furnace and such. And yet, at the end of the day, the Prime Minister continually says there is not a business case for this. Let's bring in George Monastiriakis, the latest from him in the Post, the geopolitical and environmental case for Canadian liquid natural gas. We're forcing our allies to rely on dirtier fuels supplied by dictators. To talk more about all of this, George Monastiriakis is with us, adjunct professor, University of Ottawa, Faculty of Law, and here now. George, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Thank you for having me, Scott. I appreciate the invite.
George, how often do we have to have this discussion before it resonates? We've got leaders coming here asking for this. It seems we're more concerned about the 1.5% of greenhouse gases we emit as opposed to what the rest of the world produces by running on coal. Why are we not all rowing in the same direction and just trying to get the world off coal to start?
I think that, we could look at this question from many angles. Mainly, I think that there's been a lot of fear-mongering regarding climate change, especially how to combat climate change. And one of these phenomenon has been going against fossil fuels like gas. And you've seen this play out, and it's mainly, in my opinion, again, the federal government pandering to this part of the party that is more likely to vote NDP, and they're trying to keep them on base. And so we've kind of shot ourselves in the foot over the last, I want to say, 9 years regarding this question. We could have been greenlighting, approving both export terminals. We could have been approving pipelines. Some of the pipelines that were approved got canceled and bought over by the federal government. I mean, it's been a fiasco. And now we're basically back where we started with everybody kind of asking us, okay, Canada, you guys can produce LNG both in Asia and in Europe. And I mean, we have our prime minister saying that there's no business case, particularly as relates to the Atlantic, the transatlantic alliance. And so I guess that's where we are today. And that's kind of what I wanted to touch on in this piece.
And it's not only climate change here. It's getting these countries off of the dependence of other dictatorships.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so that's, for me, I mean, we've seen the fallout from Russia's illegal, unjustified, and brutal invasion of Ukraine, especially the full-scale invasion that happened after February 24, 2022. And so Europe has scrambled for these new gas supplies. And so you've had a series of leaders from Europe and from Asia as well to get off of these Russian fossil fuels. And time and time again, we've basically told them, thanks for your interest, but there's no business case. Thanks for coming, but you've got to go with someone else. And again, Canada is in a unique position. We want to transition to renewables. Like I mentioned in the piece, it's an achievable goal, and it's a worthy goal as well. Whereas our allies in Europe, they're not energy independent, right? They have to export energy. So now they've shut down the pipes coming from Russia for the most part, and they're transitioning away from that. And who has stepped into the foray? We've got Algeria now pumping more gas, Azerbaijan piping pipeline gas as well, and the United States mainly, and Qatar shipping LNG. And so why aren't we having, I mean, I don't want to say our slice of the pie here, but I mean, we could be helping them, right? It seems to me like low-hanging fruit. You've got Chancellor Scholz coming here and saying, look, Canada, you're our partner of choice. Give us a signal. And
well, you know, You know as well as I do, George, it's fossil fuels, and that's a bad word. And you made reference to this in your article. I mean, I've had many energy experts on this show talk about how, of course, we have to move towards this, but we can't put all of our eggs in one basket. And that's what we're doing here. So my, you know, if you're the government, the answer to Europe is, well, why don't you just use renewables like we're trying to pressure all Canadians to? And why don't they? Why are they depending on liquid natural gas? And, you know, I'm obviously being cynical here, but you go back to Germany in the last 10, 20 years, they've been on the forefront of renewables, and yet they're the ones as well that are begging for natural gas. So how do they square this circle?
Well, Germany in particular is an interesting case, because what you saw is there was the 2011 nuclear power plant disaster in Japan. And after this, they basically phased out their transition to nuclear, which their partner France is mostly on nuclear energy, and so they phased that out and they transitioned back to coal and obviously gas. And so they went through with Nord Stream 1, and then despite Russia annexing Crimea in 2014, they went forward with Nord Stream 2. So this has been kind of a, I mean, for me, it makes no sense whatsoever from the European perspective. But again, Europe is not Canada. They can't rely on this. They can't rely on renewables. They can't rely on being energy independent. They need to import gas. They need to import oil. And they will continue to do this from whoever is willing to supply them. And it's the same thing for Japan. Same thing for South Korea, right?
Why are we not looking at this solution as a global perspective? You know, all we hear is gotta cut. But here's a perfect example where, you know, maybe Canada should even increase by a half a point to help the rest of the world get off coal. Yet it seems the environmentalists, in a sense, have failed, the extreme environmentalists, because they're telling you to shut off everything before there's alternatives. And they're not really leading us to the goal, which is less emissions by getting rid of the dirtiest polluters.
And so I think this is in many ways, this is a unique, like a problem that is very unique to Canada in the sense that Canada is a little isolated from history. If you go around the world, you'll see, for example, China, they're still building coal power plants today.
Yeah.
They're building coal plants, and you can transition them. You can help replace those coal power plants with gas, with LNG. And it's not like hydrogen energy or nuclear energy or hydropower, where the transition might take a generation. We're talking 25 years. This can happen. I mean, a year, 2 years, 3 years. It's almost like immediate. And LNG, not only does it not emit air pollution, so no soot, no dust, but it also generates up to 40% less carbon dioxide than coal does. So, I mean, to me, it seems like low-hanging fruit. It seems like the obvious thing to do. But once you have a portion of the population that has become so anti-fossil fuels, anti-gas, and I mean, I don't want to borrow from Pierre Poilievre, but anti-common sense, I mean, this is the result that you end up with.
Do you see this? Is this resonating with Canadians? Is this discussion changing in the sense that we're all concerned about climate change? It's just the way we're going about it that just seems misguided.
Well, I think. I mean, if we look at recent polls regarding the carbon tax, for example.
Yeah.
This has been playing out in front of our eyes. And at first, a couple years back, you had popular support for the carbon tax. And now you have more and more Canadians saying, look, maybe this is not the right way to go about it. And one of the arguments I keep hearing from the people that I discuss this with is regarding carbon pricing for consumers and not just for the institutions, right? For the
for industry,
at the end of the day, exactly, for industry.
George Monastirakis is with us. I got to cut you off there, George. Adjunct professor, University of Ottawa, Faculty of Law. The business case for Canadian liquid natural gas, despite what the Prime Minister says, seems to be growing. George, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you, Scott. Have an excellent day.
The Prime Minister facing criticism from Pierre Poilievre for his disclosure to the Foreign Interference Commission. He rarely reads intelligent documents. Wait, it's not over. Jagmeet Singh of the NDP said the New Democrats no longer believe that the carbon tax, well, is the be-all and the end-all, and supported Pierre Poilievre's move to have a discussion with the premiers on the carbon tax. What is going on? Tim Powers, Chairman Summa Strategies, Managing Director Abacus Data, all here. Tim, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Good to be with you, Scott. Thanks be to God it's Friday, right? Or TGIF, whatever.
Yes! So let's start with the NDP. What's with Jagmeet Singh?
What's that song by Europe, The Final Countdown? It's kind of like that. I think he sees, certainly the NDP in Alberta, have said they are moving away from supporting personal carbon levies. He's seen Liberal premiers of mine in Newfoundland and Labrador and other Liberal leaders do that. I think he has discovered how toxic it is and now is trying to back away from it, which I don't know how successful he will be in terms of getting any political credit for that, given his relationship with the Liberal government and his long-held praise of said mechanism.
So now what happens?
Well, I guess he just does it, right? But what does it matter? Unless he's going to say to the PM, which I don't have any sense that he will, if you don't put a pause on carbon pricing, as say Premier Fury has argued, I'm going to stop supporting you. So it doesn't mean anything unless he decides to use the most potent lever he has, which is confidence in the government. And, the government has a budget coming up, and there are at least two or three confidence votes that come with the budget. So he could say, I won't support you with the budget vote unless you move it back. You pause the carbon price. But I don't see that happening. I don't think he's giving any indication that that's on the table.
Over and above all of that, and again, there's no reason for him to pull the plug. He's got most leverage and power that he does now, meaning Jagmeet Singh. Yep. That being said, it's the carbon tax is not the be-all and the end-all. What does that mean? How does the Prime Minister interpret that? How are Canadians supposed to interpret that?
Yeah, that one I don't know, because it certainly has been put forward by Mr. Singh and others who have been long advocating for carbon pricing as one of the best tools that's out there, right?
Yeah.
Now, all of a sudden, they're saying that, or he's saying that it's not. It's hard then to say, all right, well, where is your credibility? If for good or for bad, you can say this about Trudeau. He's sticking with his price and his pricing scheme because he believes in it. But if Mr. Singh is all of a sudden going to go wishy-washy, he loses his pulpit to tell other people what the best mechanism is or isn't when it comes to dealing with GHG2 reductions.
At the end of the day, Tim, isn't the carbon tax and this whole movement all that Justin Trudeau has left? Because the rest is in shambles. Yet, for some reason, despite population, despite housing, despite healthcare or any of these rippling effects that we're seeing with stress on systems, We're supposed to believe him on this one. I got this one right. This is the last thing he has.
I guess he would argue, Scott, that he's got daycare, right? But then there's lots of challenges around the $10 a day program, as in Ontario.
And that didn't move the numbers for the NDP at all, as PharmaCare.
Yeah. You're talking Mr. Trudeau or Mr. Singh? This is the last thing who has. Mr. Trudeau?
Mr. Trudeau, yes.
Based on our Abacus poll of yesterday, his budget announcements so far are not resonating. Now, our view is that you probably won't see the full measure of them until after after the budget of next week, meaning people have had a full 2 or 3 weeks to them set in. But I would think you'd see a couple of point improvement if people were saying, hey, he gets it on affordability now, and I like the school lunch program, or I like the housing. Yeah, I mean, at a certain point, unless the prime minister has lost all sense that he once had, because you have to say he's had some useful political sense. He's won 3 elections.
Mm-hmm.
He's got to look at this and say, all right, I have just announced billions of dollars in spending. I have announced programs that some are getting praised, but I'm not getting any movement in the polls. Where's the trouble lie? And maybe look in the mirror.
Really quickly, the foreign interference inquiry, his performance this week, where we are, your thoughts?
Yeah, I would say, look, I know people are making a lot about him not reading briefing notes. I know other leaders who don't either, right? So I don't think that's the bigger issue. I think the bigger
But they
issue
don't get
is-
caught.
Well, fair point. But there are a lot of people who get briefed early. I think the bigger issue is that what we've learned is there is foreign interference. It is happening. It may not be material yet, but we have to be more serious in our approach. And there's a criticism there to be levied on the prime minister, the security agencies for all of that, Scott, for sure.
All right. Well, you enjoy hockey tonight.
Oh, it's tomorrow morning, buddy. Bright and early in soccer as well. You have a good weekend.
Tim Powers, Chairman, Summa Strategies, Managing Director, Abacus Data. Have a great weekend. Thank you, Tim.
Yeah, you're welcome.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, Today's Talk.
900 CHML.
The Liberals have been rolling out a budget announcement a day since late last month. The budget comes out April 16th. Instead of blowing it all in one day, they're doing it over a series of, well, every day since the end of last month, and concentrating on housing in the last couple of days, including today, the Prime Minister announcing what he called the biggest housing policy in the free world. Certainly in decades, as he's saying, and a lot of it, what many experts and even opposition have suggested for a long period of time, but it seems that this is the future for the Liberal Party. That's the direction they want you to think they're going in. Let's bring in Mike Collins-Williams, CEO, West End Home Builders Association, in here now. Mike, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Your thoughts on all of this? A lot of it is suggestions that have been brought up in the past to try to solve these issues. How long is it going to take for this stuff to get traction, dig in, and resonate to our doorstep?
Well, there's been a flurry of federal announcements that cover a wide range of different issues. Some of the announcements will have a quicker impact, and some, you know, it does take a while to build housing. So some of those announcements will take a while to have an impact. But overall, it's been a pretty positive few days for housing in terms of what the federal government, the federal Liberal Party, has brought to the table.
Again, as we've suggested, and we've had many housing experts on over the course of time that have, suggested things like this or very close to it. Why do you think this is happening now in one giant sort of process?
I think there's been a ton of pressure on all levels of government that, you know, the housing crisis has been around for a while, but it has really bubbled up to become potentially the number one issue. And for the next federal election, whenever that happens, potentially 2025, and, you know, maybe the next provincial election in 2026, we have the fastest growing country in the G7. We are growing by leaps and bounds, and the pressure on the housing supply has reached a point where young people aren't just frustrated. I think they're angry. And a lot of new Canadians, immigrants, the best and the brightest from around the world that have come here, are finding out that the Canadian dream's not all it's cracked up to be because they can't find housing.
Why not make these decisions before you increase or spend the last couple of years increasing the population to the extent that it's increased? Should this not have been done first?
A good question for the politicians in terms of the decision making. You know, I guess I'll give them kudos for making some good decisions now, but we are in a bit of a mess. And to your first question, it's going to take a while to dig out of it. So the announcements made around 30-year amortizations for first-time buyers, for significant infrastructure investments, some changes, some very technical stuff in terms of GST relief and capital cost allowances for purpose-built rental. These are all positive things, but they do take a while to actually get traction.
Should this not be ongoing policy, not something that gets announced this way? In other words, it seems that we wait till there's a problem before we announce a solution. As you mentioned, Canada's growing. We're starting to expand. We've let, over a million people in each year for the last couple of years. Yet, you know, we need more of everything. In society, should this not be an ongoing plan, an ongoing observation by all governments?
It's very interesting how governments shift their approach when an election is coming. So I think this is very clear that the federal governing party sees that an election is around the corner and that this has become the number one issue, and they're going at it pretty hard. The 30-year amortization is good news for first-time home buyers, and it's geared towards new construction only, which is positive because that actually supports the construction of new housing supply versus it being just directed to existing. And, you know, there are some demand issues there, and some of the tax changes will impact the developers choosing to build more purpose-built rentals. Basically, this country built a lot of purpose-built rentals in the 60s and 70s, stopped in the 80s, 90s, and in the last couple of decades, and it's starting to come back, and these tax policy changes will make a huge difference. But, you know, even if a shovel goes in the ground tomorrow, it does take a few years for meaningful supply to be built. So to your original question, it's going to take a while for this to have the real impact.
I remember, and I think, Mike, I've had this discussion with you over the last year or two, or in a post-pandemic world, is that it seemed for the longest time the word build was a bad word, whether it's municipalities, provinces, federally, what have you, because if you build, you increase your footprint, and that's bad for the environment. Have we changed that perception? Is build still a bad word here?
I don't know if the perception's completely changed. There is incredible urgency to do more, and we need to do more of everything. I think sometimes, unfortunately, the politics around this suggest that we should only be building one type or a couple types of housing.
Yeah,
we are growing as a society in all facets. Young singles need places to live. Older seniors need places to live. Growing families need multiple bedrooms and larger homes, perhaps homes with a backyard. So we do need to grow up taller buildings in, which means increasing densities in existing neighborhoods, including fourplexes. And we do need to grow out through some strategic boundary expansions and build new communities targeting families.
All right. Isn't the fourplex the thing really a red herring at the end of the day? Because you still can build fourplexes. It just takes the approval of the municipality. So is that not just a red herring we're getting caught in as opposed to just building the dang things?
It's one small piece of the puzzle. And the problem has gotten to the point where we can't be picking and choosing from the menu. We need to be at the all-you-can-eat buffet and building all of everything. And a lot of the politics seem to be trying to be very selective in what we do. But, you know, today is a good news day where some positive things have come out. There's enough bad news in society that I think some positive housing announcements should be celebrated.
Mike Collins-Williams with us, CEO, West Ham Home Builders Association. Mike, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
The inquiry into foreign interference. It's something that all Canadians need to follow, especially if you believe in democracy. Let's get his take on the week that was. Charles Burton, senior fellow with Synopsis. And here now, Charles Burton, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am, Scott. Good to speak with you.
Your thoughts on the week that was, I'll leave it at that. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, there has been progress. You know, one of the things that the commission was supposed to establish was there or was there not Chinese interference in the 2019 and 2021 elections? And, you know, we have seen documents from CSIS that say that there was. And so that's good enough for me. If CSIS says there was interference and gives the reasons why, that, you know, that pretty much suggests to me that that's what happened. But for our prime minister, not so much.
He was actually asked if he was aware that the interference by the Chinese Communist Party benefited the Liberals, and he said he didn't.
Yeah, I mean, you know, give me a break. I mean, the Conservatives' policy in that election under Erin O'Toole mentioned China 35 times and suggested things like a Foreign Influence Transparency Scheme Act or a Foreign Agent Registry Act, getting out of the AIIB, and like all sorts of things that China definitely would not have liked to have seen made into the laws of Canada. And so, you know, I mean, anyone with any reasonable judgment would say that the Chinese would prefer the Liberals, who had no real policy on China whatsoever. Just let it go the way it's been going was their attitude. And that's the policy that they have, in fact, implemented now that they've won the election. I think the, you know, the whole question of what did the prime minister know, when did he know it, and why didn't he act on it is being reviewed in the course of this inquiry. I mean, initially it was supposed to end on Wednesday with the evidence given by the prime minister's advisors in the prime minister's office and the prime minister himself. And when the lawyers produced these secret documents that were marked, you know, notes for briefing with the prime minister, the prime minister and his staff said, no, we never heard that from David Villeneuve, the head of CSIS, that, you know, that we don't know what that document is, and they never said anything like that to us. So then they called Mr. Villeneuve back on Friday and said, you know, what's going on here? We assumed that if the document said briefing notes for briefing to the prime minister, that that's what you told him. And he said, well, maybe we didn't tell him absolutely everything, but all the points, the main points, were repeated over and over in briefings, which was that there's Chinese influence in our election process, that we don't seem to have anything to disincentive them from doing it. It's low cost and risk-free, and that we are behind our Five Eyes and other like-minded partners in trying to do something about foreign interference in our democratic institutions. You know, he said that he made that point over and over again. So the implication is, you know, the prime minister would have heard that. But the other thing the prime minister is saying is that we don't really trust what CSIS tells us. You know, we have to look into it more closely. And just because they say this is so, we don't take that at face value. Well, that's a pretty damning statement about our intelligence and security services. And if he feels that they're not providing him with advice that he can, with, you know, information he can accept unconditionally, why doesn't he do something to get CSIS into shape?
That almost sounds like something out of Donald Trump's playbook, that he's challenging the institutions. The institutions are incorrect, except obviously from the other political extreme. Can you keep using the excuse, I didn't know, when there's all this proof around that clearly, unless you didn't open your eyes, you did know?
I think that that's the thing. There does seem to be some element of willful blindness. And CSIS had raised concerns about the riding of Don Valley North with Han Dong, apparently many times to the prime minister. And, you know, he just clearly didn't want to know about this. There's a sort of willful blindness element that seems to be creeping in there. I think that, you know, there are a lot of documents that we haven't seen, but which the commissioner, Justice Oak, has. She gets the secret documents unredacted. And I think on May the 3rd, we may see that this commission says some things that suggest that our government has not been handling this very well. And certainly, I think the idea that there was some sort of distortion in the reporting in the Globe and Mail and Global News has been proven wrong, because all the documents that we've seen just seem to affirm what Bob Fyfe and Steve Chase were telling us in the Globe and what Sam Cooper was saying in Global News and afterwards when he went out on his own. And so you wonder about the special rapporteur's report, which had suggested, that those reports were not depicting the situation accurately and there was no need for a public inquiry. That kind of things that calling into question the integrity of those journalists does not seem to be standing up to further scrutiny.
Especially when in the beginning, I mean, he accused the reporters of, he played the racism card. He denied any of this was going on, refused to call an inquiry, as you mentioned, the David Johnston fiasco. And now this, it's interesting. I read on social media from somebody that said he seems genuine, but the story just doesn't seem to add up. It's like people want to believe him, but there's just so many other facts that they can't. Yet, because he repeats his taglines or his sale lines so often, they just, they seem to believe him, Canadians. Is that accurate? Are they digesting this?
I think that is an issue. And, you know, you said in your introduction that this is important. It is important. I mean, we should have elections where every seat has been determined by the will of the voters in the riding and not due to shenanigans on the part of a foreign power to try and further their own interests. But, you know, I think for most Canadians, they're more concerned about things like the cost of housing, interest rates, other social issues, and foreign policy is not something that they see as a priority. And this particular matter is just too confusing. And as you say, they're getting mixed signals from the journalists, from the opposition parties, from the prime minister and his staff. And I think a lot of people just don't know what to make of it. And that is unfortunate, because we really need to move on this and get this foreign influence out of our system before the next election.
And they keep trying to sell the liberals that, you know, it didn't change the result of anything. That's not the point. And never has that ever been suggested by anybody, I don't think, on the opposition. That's not the point. The point is, if they're doing this much now, how much are they going to be doing next time until it becomes an issue?
Yes. And I mean, every seat counts. I mean, everyone agrees that the government would still be the liberals, that the conservatives would still be in opposition. But, you know, there are six MPs that did not get elected when they should have. And that means that there are six MPs in parliament who really shouldn't have been elected, because the foreign influence was what, turned the balance in their favor. So, you know, that is completely unacceptable, and we shouldn't be tolerating it. And the fact that the government downplays this and doesn't seem to be suggesting that they're going to do anything differently next time is a big concern. I mean, you know, I'd expected that they might say, well, if we'd known what we know now, back then, we would have acted differently. But the government has not made any kind of concession that perhaps they had misjudged the situation or hadn't given enough importance to these very serious violations of our security and sovereignty by a Chinese regime that is hostile to our purposes and wants to subvert our democracy.
Perhaps because it benefits the liberals. Charles Burton with a senior fellow with Synopsis. And of course, always, Charles, we enjoy having you on. Be well. Have a great weekend.
You too, Scott. Take care.
Scott Radley, you can read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He is here now. Scott, I hope you're doing well.
Couldn't be better, Scott. It's Friday. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Do you want to talk about National Grilled Cheese Day, or do you want to talk about Jagmeet Singh calling the carbon tax not the be-all and end-all?
That, you know, okay, we can take a minute and talk about grilled cheese in a minute, but, you know, it's funny. Dave Woodard and I in the newsroom just before I came in here were talking about this, because how bad must internal polling be by the NDP about this? How unpopular must this carbon tax idea be across this country?
I don't know about the internal. I don't know about the internal poll, but Abacus has them down 2, and the Liberals up 1, the Conservatives up 3. So obviously, the Liberals are gaining from the NDP.
But just the carbon tax idea that there must be this must they must see this as being such a negative that they would step away from this, because they're tied at the hip with the Liberals on just about everything because of their agreement. Yeah. There must be just, I can't think of another, can you think of another reason other than polling saying run from this as fast as you can because it's taking you down?
Absolutely not. It is the only reason, because again, just 3 weeks ago, he voted for increasing the carbon tax. Now he's saying it's not the be all and the end all. What the heck does that mean? This is the entire plank of this government.
And so, once again, Scott, we're back to what you and I have talked about a couple times on this issue, not on carbon tax, on Jagmeet Singh, which is will, if this comes up and if it's part of the budget or if it's part of something else, will he say, we're not confident in this government, vote against this government and bring about an election? And I'm betting no, that they're going to say, no, we don't support this, but not enough that we want to have an election, which would then, in my mind, undermine everything he says and make it totally lacking any credibility or any oomph. If you either stand for what you believe or you stand for nothing.
I think it is also becoming obvious how extreme to the left the NDP are. I think we saw that with Sarah Jama and what happened in Hamilton. Also, a new poll today that Bonnie Crombie's Liberals, and she doesn't even have a seat yet, they, if an election was held tomorrow, they'd be the official opposition. The NDP would be out the door. So I think NDP is just, whether it's provincially or federal, they need to readjust something. They keep going to the extreme, and it would appear certainly provincially in this situation that the province is moving back to the center, whether it's liberal or conservative. And, you know, federal is obviously a different thing. But look at the NDP out west, completely different party that have eliminated the Liberals altogether and are a viable option out west. Yet here, most people just think they're extremists because their policies are such.
So do you think the NDP are trying to get an inside position on the Liberals and be less extreme than the Liberals and make the Liberals the left party?
No.
But stepping away from this carbon tax. So what I'm waiting to see next, and maybe I just missed it, maybe it's already out there. But okay, if the NDP are saying we don't support the carbon tax, but they clearly are not stepping away from green projects and the environment. So what is their proposal? And is the idea here, well, let's not really stake a position on this one because it's perilous territory we're seeing. This is an area of concern. People are really, Scott, concerned about their pocketbooks, about paying their bills, about putting food on the table right now. And the environment, I think people are concerned about it, but you look at polls, the numbers seem to be down as far as where this is in the pecking order. Personal finance is clearly the driving thing right now. And while we are concerned about the environment, I don't think people are interested or as interested in doing stuff to help the environment that's going to make it more difficult to live. So if you're the NDP, where do you find yourself in this thing so you look like you're doing what you say you want to do, but not becoming less popular? That's a tricky one.
Well, everybody's pointing to Pierre Poilievre. Well, what's your plan? What's your plan? Which, of course, you will never hear until an election's called, just the same with when the Liberals are running. So now, you know, so you're constantly, what's the conservative plan? They have no plan. Well, what's the NDP plan? Because clearly they're not supporting the Liberal plan.
Which you're right. It now puts the NDP in a tougher position to be screaming, as you say, at the Liberals, at the conservatives.
Plan?
What's your plan? You tell us yours. You show me yours first. It's like when you were kids.
The
funny thing about this is that Pierre Poilievre, for the fact that Jagmeet Singh has been just teeing off on him endlessly for grocery bills and other things, I would argue that he's outmaneuvered Jagmeet Singh time and again, and Jagmeet Singh may have put himself in a tough spot again. I know you yesterday when we were chatting said that Jagmeet Singh, I assume you were serious, that he wants to come back on your show.
Yeah, all of a sudden that went dead. It went crickets. All of a sudden we didn't hear anything. It was okay. Over.
So assuming that happens again, I would love to know.
Oh, I got plenty of questions.
You're going to need a 4-hour special Scott Thompson special. I'll abdicate my time to you if he wants to go past 6 o'clock, because I think that would be fascinating. But yeah, there are a million things now. And I keep coming back to my number one thing that I know people are getting tired of hearing me say. And so I apologize. But the fact is, if everything that Justin Trudeau is doing you take issue with, why do you keep propping him up? If you continue to prop up someone who is doing things that you believe are bad for the country, but you're the one who's allowing him to do it, you are equally culpable. Why are you propping him up if he's doing bad things for the country?
Because it's the best I can do. All right, Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Have a great one. Have a great weekend.
You as well. Stay dry.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. This one via email from David. What's with Jagmeet Singh? It looks like the NDP and Jagmeet have finally stopped drinking the Liberal Kool-Aid. They appear to have grown tired of eating the leftovers and crumbs from the Liberals, and they have their they have set their sights on eating the Liberals' lunch. Good luck with that. I hope the Jagmeet and the NDP like eating crow, because that is all the Liberals have left to eat. Signed, Dave.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.